A wishing rock? That just is insane.
Hello, and welcome to episode 25 of the My Movie DNA podcast. My name is Johnny Andrews. I'm a movie-loving Englishman, and I'm coming to you from Auckland, New Zealand. Thank you for tuning in. This is a podcast all about movies and what they mean to us. Previous guests include Tarquin Gotch, John Hughes's legendary music supervisor, flipchart comedian Beck Hill, and Taika Waititi's favourite Wellington policewoman, Karen O'Leary. My guest for this episode is Mutant Records co-founder Mo Shafiq. Mo started Mutant Records earlier this year in January 2024, with fellow founding members of Mondo's poster and vinyl divisions. They really are the hot new label in town, and it's been great to see them hit the ground running with some big name releases already. This conversation was recorded online in early May of 2024. Our talk covers the Wachowskis, Josie and the Pussycats, and Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross's awesome music to Luca Guadagnino's Challengers. We talk about Mo's recent trip to Hawaii to see Michael Giacchino conducting the 20th anniversary concert for the TV show Lost, and we discuss the process of getting artwork approved by the great Tom Cruise. Okay, here we go. Hey Mo.
How you doing?
Good, how are you?
I'm all right, can you hear me okay?
I can hear you and I can see you, which is great.
Amazing.
How's Austin? Is it Austin?
Yeah, Austin. Yeah, thank you. It's muggy.
Oh, really?
It's humid. We're in the last vestiges of springtime,
yep.
Which means that it's wet, it's moldy, it's green, and green probably for the last time for the next 6 months.
Right, and then it'll be like a desert, I'm guessing.
Yeah, Texas's summers are pretty brutal. It's a tricky place to live because I don't really like winters very much.
Oh yeah.
And here we don't really get them, but we certainly make up for it with summers.
Hey,
Mission Impossible box set behind you.
That's right, and it's all full as well, or you know, full up to date.
Yeah.
Thank you for joining me, first of all.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. You are one of my soundtrack heroes. So as I said in my email to you, your work for Mondo and now Mutant has really shaped my record collection over the last like 10 years or so. So this is like a bit of a dream come true for me.
You're welcome, or I'm sorry.
Yeah, you have cost me a lot of money, but apart from that, yeah.
extra money too, because you have to pay those import fees.
It's not great. Yeah,
it's a real shame because the world is so small now, in so many ways. You know, the technology we share, the passions we share, and how quickly we communicate with one another. But sometimes when I'm abroad, and shopping, I see how much our records, yeah, past and present cost in other countries. And I'm like, oh, there's gotta be a better way.
Yeah. No, it's not too bad. It's a nice hobby to have, I think.
Yeah. No, trust me. As you can see behind
yes,
me,
yeah.
I'm also guilty of sin.
Yeah. My first question for you, how was Hawaii?
Oh my God. It was really great, beautiful. It's paradise. I don't know if you've ever been.
No.
You know, you're in New Zealand, right?
Correct.
Another sort of island paradise, right?
Yeah.
Ish.
Very Polynesian as well here, so it's, you know, a little bit like Hawaii, I would have thought.
Yeah, you know, we were in Oahu and in the Waikiki, Honolulu area. So it's a little commercey. It's a little busy. And we were doing a lot of work. I was there for a half work, half vacation trip with Michael Giacchino playing the 20th anniversary of Lost concert. And we had a limited edition 7-inch release that we did there. But beyond just the work aspect of it, my wife and I have now been basically once a year since we started going in 2019, with a little bit of an exception during the pandemic. But it's our new favorite place to go. It's our vacation destination of choice. And I love it there, and I highly encourage anyone who's never been to go visit and be respectful. But it's paradise. You know, like you can read about it all you want. onesie photos of it, and then you go and you go, oh, I get it.
It
I
is
get
paradise.
Why people adopt this as their whole entire personality after going once.
And how was the concert? Because I had pangs of jealousy last weekend because I follow you on Instagram, so I saw you post a couple of things. I follow Michelle from Enjoy the Ride. So I saw some
yes.
things from her. And then I also follow, I don't know what she's called, but the lady who did the art for Mondo's Videodrome.
Annette.
Yes.
Oh yeah. So Annette, yeah, she did the art, she did liner notes, but yes, Annette was there as well. And yeah, when the concert was first announced, the crew was thick. There was a lot of people all of a sudden going, and I was like, okay, go off, Michael, generating the boost, single-handedly boosting Hawaiian tourism for a weekend. But no, yeah. I think that, you know, Lost fans in general came out in droves, and you know, I'm so glad I went. You know, I've never actually seen Michael perform live. I've known Michael for close to a decade now, and believe it or not, I just haven't really been able to see him conduct. I've seen him do a lot of things. I've seen him in the studios. I've seen him in his own recording studio and also at different various recording studios, but never conducting a live orchestra. And it was a sight to behold. But also, you know, I lived with that concert for a couple of years. When he did it in Dublin, we did a vinyl release for it yep. over at Mondo in collaboration with Disney Music that we put out. And that concert, me and my friend from Disney Music, we wanted to go to that one, and both of us could not justify the the trip to Ireland. Yeah. But as soon as this show was announced, we were both like, okay, this is a makeup. This is a makeup for missing the Dublin concert. Yeah. So it was nice to finally see it live after having heard it for so many times. And we got the extra special version of it that had Evangeline Lilly and Ian Cusack there doing readings. I'm sure you saw some photos of it, but Ian Cusack, who played Desmond on Lost, yep. did a reading of The Constant and also did a reading from my favorite episode of television ever, Through the Looking Glass, which is the season 3 finale of Lost with the quote unquote Not Penny's Boat, for those I won't spoil any of that. Yes, but he had it written on his hand and did that as a little surprise to the audience, and everyone lost their mind. There was this poor usher in the audience was supposed to stop anyone from taking their camera out and their phone out during it. And I just saw him zooming around the venue because I saw a lot of photos after the fact, but they must have been much sneakier because I saw the man zigzagging around the theater, stopping people from taking their phone out. It was very funny.
And I'm guessing that was a better makeup from the island gig, because Lost was filmed in Hawaii, right? That's the whole point
yes.
of that.
They Carlton Cuse, who made an appearance as well, the showrunner of Lost, he said during the concert that all but 5 scenes of Lost were filmed on Oahu. Wow. That means anytime it was in Africa, England, Los yeah. Angeles, Sydney.
So all the flashback
Korea,
stuff essentially was all...
Everything wow. was in Oahu. So I have someone who I made friends with during the weekend who has been posting on his socials, visiting nearly every filming location, including the like opening bamboo groves, like yeah. real deep dive stuff. Like when I first went to the island, I was like, I got to go see the Others Village. Cause like that to me was like the most iconic visual strike that I can very clearly be like, that is where the Others lived, right? The yellow barracks. And I found that in 2019 and it was still yellow. They've since been painted blue. So if you weren't there before, whatever, the pandemic, they are now yellow. Maybe to drive away the droves of tourists who are coming yeah. by. But but this person visited so many places, like you name it, like the temple that's behind Jin and Sun when they're getting married, the convention center that doubles for the LAX airport, the like, you know, the abandoned mental hospital, all these different places that are like just straight up shot in Oahu and, you know, double for Los Angeles or any of these different places. It's great. It's so
fantastic.
Cool. And yeah, so going to Oahu was definitely a more honest, devotional fandom experience than going to Dublin. Though I've never been to Dublin, I would love to go. It sounds like it's also a really lovely place.
Hey, so this is My Movie DNA, so I'm going to talk to you about your favorite movies and the movies that made you. The one question I didn't send you, and this should hopefully take you by surprise, is what was the last movie you watched?
Oh dear. When is this coming out?
This will come out, I'm hoping, not this Monday, but the following Monday.
Okay.
Have you seen something?
I'll say something. I've seen something that isn't out yet.
Yeah.
That was the last movie I saw. I guess it's not illegal for me to say this because it just premiered, but I just saw.
Oh, nice.
And I'm very excited to talk about that someday, but I won't do that right now.
Sure.
Before that, I may have to pull up my letterbox to tell you because I watch a lot of movies. Oh, you know what I just watched? This is actually a better subject. On the flight home from Oahu, I watched a documentary called David Holmes, The Boy Who Lived.
Ah,
I don't know if you are
Harry
aware
Potter,
of it.
Thing. I've got it on my watch list, but I've not got around to it yet.
Have you seen The Fall Guy yet?
No.
Okay, so The Fall Guy comes out today when we're recording this. The David Holmes, The Boy Who Lived, is a documentary about, for those who don't know, about Daniel Radcliffe, the star of Harry Potter's stunt double through the first seven, through all the films, up until the very final film, where in pre-production, a practice stunt disabled him from the neck down, basically for life. And it's about his perpetual optimism, his love of the craft, how much he misses it, and his friendships, and how this whole thing plays into what people who make art for a living sort of the ups and downs, things you don't see behind the scenes. And like, so the reason I bring up The Fall Guy is because I feel like it's actually a really good companion film, because the Fall Guy, which I love, is a popcorn rock and roll movie, right? It's an excuse for them to just show off stunts over and over again with a thinly, you know, developed plot. And I mean that in a polite way. That's just an excuse for stunt doubles to do crazy things on screen for you in the guise of celebrating the art form of stunts, right? And how much work goes into it and how much you don't see it as an audience member, but how many people are risking their lives every day just to entertain you. And this is a good counterpoint to that about the, like, you know, the occasional negative side to that. And, you know, but also in the, like, don't cry for me, I knew what I was doing.
Yeah.
I loved this work and this was always the risk I was willing to take. And unfortunately, this is the outcome of being that, not guileless, but, you know, you roll the dice and every now and then you get snake eyes. Right.
Sure.
And it's really moving. It's really special. And I really enjoyed it. It hit me way harder than I thought it was, because I'm not even like that big of a Harry Potter fan. So I actually haven't revisited those films since they were in theaters, honestly. Mm-hmm. I know some people who watch those things like every Christmas, right? But seeing some of that footage of young Daniel Radcliffe and this young stuntman, David Holmes, just like goofing off behind the scenes, and then revisiting the prop collections at the end of this doc, it's like, it was really touching, because I was like, oh, I should revisit these, because I forgot. Like, nowadays when I think of big budget production, I think of just, you know, a lot of stuff done in post and CGI and very little of it being practical and on the screen. But the Harry Potter films, a lot of that stuff was really like a lot of that stuff was real, and pretty, because technology was limited, right? And for better or for worse, I bet it still looks good, because that was sort of the era where you kind of had to pick and choose what you put into your CGI budget. And it from what I can gather, still looks great. There are a lot of really amazing below the line craft technicians at their absolute peak on those movies, and it's really special.
I don't know about you, but I always find if I watch something like that on a plane and it's completely, you know, heart wrenching, being on a plane just makes it worse, and it's like it makes everything even sadder, and you know, you can be like, you know, tears streaming down your face.
Yeah, I could tell it was affecting.
Yeah.
Actually affecting, and not just plane affecting.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
Because my wife who was sitting next to me had no idea what I was watching, but like 10 minutes in, she just started looking at my screen and didn't have earphones on, so just turned on the subtitles.
Yeah.
And she literally just watched it with subtitles on for the rest of the flight, which was really funny. So I was like, oh, this must have been a really compelling subject, because even without sound, I guess I was like afraid I was being manipulated by a score, you know, which is very, possible, but it was sincere.
I'll bump it up the watch list, and I'll try and get around to it, because it does sound very good.
Yeah.
Mo Shafiq, what's your earliest movie memory?
The earliest movie memory I have, and I guess this would be when I was about 5 years old, was Who Framed Roger Rabbit, specifically the judge's eyeballs at the end of the movie, and how fucking terrified I was watching that as a 5 year old. But what I would later learn from my mother over the years is that I saw that movie in theaters 6 times.
Wowzers.
Which means that, like, I wanted to keep going back.
Yeah.
And you know, when I was young, you know, obviously I was in peak VHS era. And similarly, we had a copy of Michael Jackson's Moonwalker Which is, I don't know if you've ever seen that movie or know what that is.
I saw it at the cinema. Yeah.
It's a totally normal movie with a totally normal person at the helm. But that movie opens with like a 30-minute montage of music videos. And I loved the movie, you know, Moonwalker. And then I tolerated the opening 30 minutes of, you know, music videos, except for that one chunk where all of a sudden that silly little zombie movie that is in the video, you know, Thriller, it terrified me. And so I remember I would like literally run out of the room and just time it. I knew for like 3.5 minutes, I couldn't go back in. It wasn't just a matter of fast forwarding or whatever. Yep. It was always just the zombie section is out, so I have to run out of the room. So I imagine that was probably what I was doing during Who Framed Roger Rabbit, a movie that, like, as I've gotten older, still a movie I truly adore. Like, I think it's a masterpiece. It's less for kids than I remember, you know. Yeah. Like, that is a movie that is a noir. It's like a kind of a dark story about an alcoholic who is grieving the loss of his brother and is perpetually broke and has to solve the grisly murder of somebody. It's basically Chinatown with tunes, right? And I think about me watching that movie 6 times as a kid or whatever in theaters and covering my eyes for 45 seconds when the judge what I can't do, brother. Yeah, you know, sorry for spiking your levels.
Just on the subject of Thriller, one of my local cinemas who they only play retro stuff, which is fantastic. I speak about them on this podcast all the time. Last Halloween, they played An American Werewolf in London, but for the pre-show, they played Thriller, the whole music video, and it was so fantastic to see it projected. Like, it was just perfect.
I imagine that this has probably been in 4K circles, which I'm not nearly as a part of as I should be, but I'm sure that, like, I'm sure people would buy like the steelbook of Thriller, just the music video and all the behind the scenes stuff. It's such an incredible piece of art.
Well, didn't
that I can now watch. I'm 40 years old and I can sit through all that without being scared, for the record.
Yeah, we believe you. Yeah. Because
I only have to close my eyes once or twice.
It was originally a VHS, wasn't it? When it came out, I think the music video. Yeah. Yeah. Hey, this might be a bit of a can of worms to ask you, but how on earth do you get into the world of soundtracks? Or how did you get into the world of soundtracks?
Oh my God, how does one get into the world of soundtracks? Practice, practice, practice. you know, I feel like it was a true right place, right time, right sort of cocktail of skill set. A little bit about me. Before I worked at my previous job, Mondo, where I ran the soundtrack record label for 13 years, I went to film school at NYU. I always wanted to be a filmmaker. And before that, I was just an avid collector of soundtracks and film scores. I've always loved film music. It's been, you know, a big part of my life since I was a kid. I can't remember what my first soundtrack would have been, but certainly, I mean, it was, you know, Disney stuff, probably Aladdin, Lion King, things like that were pretty easy and accessible. But then after that, I remember saving up my money, going to Suncoast Video, which is a US chain, and buying everything, even like stuff like Con Air, you know, have you ever listened to the score of Con Air?
Probably not.
It's a lot of electric guitar and like weird throat gargling noises. Like, it's the only way I can describe it. Yeah. Anyway, loved it. It was the best, and I would blast it all the time. Everything, you know, I was not like too cool for anything, but I was a huge collector of soundtracks. And I was also a tour manager. And so I was touring with gigging musicians for about 5-6 years, in the early two, right after college. And so I had like touring sales experience, music experience, film experience, and a love of film music. And then I ended up between tours working shipping, receiving work. And so I was like, I needed a part-time job to pay the bills between tours. And I ended up running a shipping warehouse out of Brooklyn for a couple of years. And then after all that, I moved with one of the bands that I was tour managing down to Austin, Texas between tours because New York was a little too expensive. And I just went and applied to this place that I really liked, this little company called Mondo that made these screen printed posters that I discovered, you know, about a year earlier. And my resume just ended up fitting the exact thing that they were looking for.
Nice.
You know, like it really was destiny or fate or whatever you would call that. That's how I got in. I do feel like it's not nearly as complicated. You don't have to have a super specialized, risky resume. I think as long as you're sincere and something, you should just follow it as a pursuit. But, you know, specifically the vinyl thing, you know, I was a collector of records, but mostly just because I like supporting the bands that I liked and having merchandise. I've always been a big merchandise person, you know, going to shows. My wife jokes about it. I go to merch booths all the time. Like, it's the first thing I want to do, even if it's an artist I don't even really that care for. You know, like if I was at a, like a Dave Matthews band, no attempt to shade Dave Matthews, but like I'm not like an avid fan, but I would always just go to be like, well, let me see what he's selling. I want to see what Dave Matthews merch looks like, right? And so things like that, like I would always just buy vinyl because I was just like, it's a big piece of art and it's my favorite album. You know, like I, you know, Get Up Kids, Something to Write Home About. I bought it on vinyl before I had a record player, just because I was like, well, this is cool. And I have an original pressing of it. It's really cool. So it's like, you know, that's, you know, you never know these things that are going to like play a role into it. I had never made a record before I started working at Mondo. But I also learned a lot of things from my mentor, Rob Jones, who came from the world of vinyl art manufacturing. Like he did all the artwork for Jack White and the White Stripes and Third Man Records. So like he taught me a lot. And then Jay Shaw, who also joined the company Mondo, also taught me a lot about design. And the time, and then also Alan Hines, who did a lot of projects for us. I learned a lot from him. And before I knew it, I was in the lab pretty much all the time working on these records. And then separately, over the many, many years, I just ended up meeting, and the music community in film is really small. And I just ended up becoming a very, very close with a lot of people who work in this industry. And we learned a lot together, people who were about my age, who all were working in film music. We all kind of came up together, and now we're all just in this really wonderful place where we're making the thing, you know, like I think we all kind of started making a thing and now we're making the thing, which is like, if you need more further context into that, you know, like because of how physical media has changed in the years, before we knew it, we were the only ones making the things that exist now.
It is strange. So I've always bought vinyl, even through the 90s. I bought vinyl, but I was mainly CDs in the 90s. And then I started buying vinyl, nothing else except vinyl from like 99 onwards. And I did buy the odd soundtrack here and there, but soundtracks just weren't that visible. Like Verez would be around and stuff. But then like all of a sudden, 10, 15 years ago, there's this massive explosion. You've got, you know, Mondo, Waxwork, all these other smaller labels pop up. It's just been, it's been fantastic ever since. And my bank manager hates me for it.
Yeah, you know, there was, it's weird to call it a gold rush because it was such a very specific, singular niche. Collecting vinyl was already kind of a niche 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And then 15 years ago. Now it's very mainstream, you know, but I will say that soundtracks on vinyl were like a niche on a niche, right?
Yeah.
And so, of course, where was that going to go? You know, also the format just doesn't really command a lot of space. You know, for those who actually collect records, they know that you can basically comfortably fit about 18 to 20 minutes of music per side. You can stretch it out a little bit more if you want to, but you know, the average film is 2 hours. So if you say the movie has over an hour of score, boom, you have a double record now. And that costs more money than a single record. So, you know, classic film scores from the 60s, 70s, 80s, they're all truncated, right? And then by the 90s in the CD format, when you all of a sudden you can fit 70 music on a single disc, a single plastic disc that costs like 60 cents to manufacture, all of a sudden it commanded, why don't we just release all the music that was in the film, you know, expanded scores, things that were unreleased. And so, you know, completionists began to grow. Yeah.
So I'm holding up a copy of Mondo's Jaws. So the original, I think the original release was a re-recording and obviously an abridged version of the score. But when this beauty arrived, I don't know, maybe five, six years ago, absolutely fantastic. So this is the actual score as composed by
Mr. Williams, maestro. But it, yeah, exactly. That's it. And so like when we started doing the records in 2011, a lot of that was like, oh, well, why don't we bring some of the like the ethos of expanded additional content that's never been on vinyl before, or things are out of print. So let's just reissue them. Right. And, you know, I think we knew we would never be able to satisfy in the way that your FSMs or La La Lands would be able to. They are like by this down to the second completionists.
Yeah.
You know, like every stinger, every swell that would be that would even be considered a film score, you know, is sometimes included in some of these things. And so when we did those, it got us some attention. But, you know, we also were mostly known for our artwork, which was kind of both our calling card and also our biggest obstacle in convincing the studios to let us do what we were going to do. In the sense that they were like, well, this, I could tell this is different enough that I don't have to think too much about what you're doing. This is clearly just for, you know, a certain type of person. And thankfully they let us, you know, it's kind of surreal. I'm thinking about it now. You just held up a copy of Joss and I'm like, oh yeah, I worked on that. Yeah. And at the time I was just so in the trenches that I didn't even think that I was like, oh, I worked on like one of the best movies ever made.
Yeah.
In helping to get some music that had never really been out. But that a lot of that work, shout out to a gentleman named Michael Mattesino, Neil S. Bulk, a lot of these producers who live in LA who like work hand in hand with Williams and his team and like help to work on the sequences and prepare these things in a way that is meaningful and accurate and approved by the composers. They produce the albums with us and we work on the artwork and get all that approved from the film studios. And so there's a lot of really incredible people who are, you know, we credit to the success of albums like that, especially things like Back to the Future that we worked on the trilogy, E.T. and Who Framed Roger Rabbit. And, you know, there's a lot of albums, Silvestri, you know, Williams, Goldsmith, you know, they all have their people who are excited to have their things out there, but also are very, very particular. And we couldn't do it without a lot. We couldn't have done it a lot without the people involved.
Growing up. So is Austin your hometown or?
It's not. I was born in New York.
Oh, New York. Okay. So that's where you ended up at film school.
Yeah. Right. I ended up in NYU.
And what sort of films were you into growing up, teenage years?
Oh, man. I really loved the 90s. You know, like I didn't go back in time too much until film school. So until I was about 18, when I was in college, I lived in explicitly in the 90s. Sure, there was movies I would rent, you know, from Blockbuster that people told me to watch. And I watched some classics, you know, on TV, but I was really thick into the 90s. And that means I was Tarantino, Kevin Smith, David Fincher, you know, you name it, like the classic 90s auteurs, Soderbergh, you know, like I was watching all that and living for that era of time. You know, the amount of Kevin Smith's regalia and merch that I was like worshiping at, you know, even I was an avid Mallrats defender. I would, you know, be like, I can't believe this movie is poorly reviewed. This movie is secretly a masterpiece, you know. 40-year-old me would like a word with 17-year-old me. But at the same time, I don't regret any of those choices because they were sincere. You know, I, being a David Fincher fan, because I saw Seven way earlier than I should have in theaters because some adult decided to take me to go see it, was really excited to go see Fight Club opening day, even though I hadn't read the book and know nothing about it. And seeing Fight Club opening day in theaters after having to ask my mom to buy me a ticket. And when we walked up to the box office and there was a sign that was like, this movie is like explicitly rated R because, you know, we're in a post-Columbine environment in the United States in October 1999. My mom's like, are you sure? And I was like, how bad could it be? I wish I had a photo of what that sign said. It was basically like, this movie is like features a lot of violence and like anti-government like propaganda and stuff like that. And this is like opening day. You do wonder why the movie tanked at the time. But yeah, I mean, movies like that were just like revolutionary to me. Even animated films, like, you know, I was big into Pixar. So you're talking like the first Toy Story, Bug's Life, and Toy Story 2. Things like Being John Malkovich, Spike Jones, Magnolia. I was obsessed with Magnolia in 1999. Another album that is really, really important to me and meaningful to me. So yeah, there's, amazing.
Beautiful. I was just listening to it yesterday. What a fantastic triple LP.
Yeah, truly. Another that one I'm very much aware that I worked on. You know, Jaws. I forgot that I was like that you held that up. Not that I forgot, but like in my head, working on Magnolia was so top of mind that like I am literally working on this thing that is so important to me. It's so strange to me that I'm working on this. And I adore that. I absolutely adore that project and how it turned out. It's really special. Thank you for buying it.
Oh, good. Yeah, no, I love it. Just going back to the 90s, I know you're a big 90s guy because I always follow. So when I look at you on Instagram, you always post these little photo montages of you finding old soundtrack CDs in stores. And I go through all of them and wow, that was on CD. Wow. And yeah, it's really good. You know, things like Cool World will, you know, and you've bought it all.
Yeah. You know what? It's so strange is that like, I do that every time my wife goes book shopping. And, it just became a hobby of mine to flip through those. And then I started buying them and then I was like, oh my God, I'm finally catching up on all the things I wanted to buy.
Sure.
When I was definitely, I could not afford it. Cause like soundtracks on CD in the 90s were like $20 to $26 at Suncoast Video. And like, you know, I fully support paying musicians and paying labels for what they deserve as I work at one now. But even then I was sort of like, I can only afford like one of these a month. Again, then I used it on the soundtrack to Con Air. think about that. But you know, there wasn't a really good use soundtrack section anywhere because those things were all by the 90s, it was becoming a very specialized thing, right? Like, sure, you can maybe find a used copy of Top Gun at your occasional used CD record store, right? Top Gun, Purple Rain, you know, the big ones, right? Things that are basically albums, not even soundtracks.
Blues Brothers.
But like film scores, oh my God, you are never running into the score to Westworld, Waterworld, or the score to X2 at your local used CD stop, you know, because like whoever was making that was a specialized indie label, and those things were not being pressed in the hundreds of thousands. And if they were, they were definitely being sold at full retail and not being ordered in quantities enough to be resold after the fact.
Yeah.
So I have just begun reclaiming my childhood by buying everything.
Nice. Keep doing
CD
it.
Because they're fine. Yeah.
Do you have a favorite movie genre?
You know, I actually don't. I will say that like the last genre that I was hip to was horror. Until then, I was pretty omnivorous. And that was horror was the last thing to crack for me. And I think in falling in love with horror recently, and then maybe recently the last decade of my life, I realize that the reason I love horror is because it's the only genre that operates explicitly as metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes me realize that I love genre as metaphor.
Yeah.
Any auteur, any filmmaker who uses their platform, whether subtextually or intentionally, to make a story that's actually really a loaded story about something else is my favorite thing. I love me a metaphor. Visual, thematic, anything you're making that is at its core really about the human condition, about how we behave with, you know, under certain situations, analogies for America's policy, foreign policy, analogies for, you know, how relationships really work. I love me a explicit metaphor, but through genre.
Yeah.
So, you know, action, horror, sci-fi. Sci-fi is a really good genre to play in this world as well. Especially when you start talking about like, oh, well, you know, Aliens is really about Vietnam, you know, like kind of thing, you know, like a lot of that stuff where you're like, you know, about the America's guilelessness and running into the storm and face planting, you know, like there's a lot of Vietnam metaphors happening in the 80s, but, you know, a lot of Desert Storm metaphors, a lot of like PTSD metaphors out there and great films from the 2000s. You know, like I love seeing the themes. We're in a, you know, not to get very political, but we're in a very post and I guess active Trump metaphor era right now, which I think people are very turned off by. And there's a couple of movies that operate in the like, how do we reconcile a post-Trump world through metaphor that are happening right now in real time. And I think it's really interesting. And I love it. I think those are my favorite types of If that's a genre, that's my favorite type.
Got it. I'm just in the middle of watching all of the Toho Godzilla films from the very beginning. Mm-hmm. So Godzilla and Godzilla adjacent. I'm 35 films in and I'm only up to the mid 70s. I'm loving them, but I mean, they are just a massive metaphor for, Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
That's a great example. Yeah. I think that's perfect. And that's why Godzilla Minus One really knocked me on my ass.
Yeah.
Because I have never seen a film after having seen so many Toho films, right? Godzilla films that reconciles with the idea that, like, maybe the government got us into this, and how do we deal with our relationship to the government and their own culpability in putting us in this war in the first place?
Yeah.
You know, and that was really kind of strange to see on display in 2024 coming out of Japan, you know, 2023 coming out of Japan. I think that's really, really amazing and profound and brave, frankly.
All of those early Toho films, they all mention the atomic bomb, as in, there's this huge alien, big monster, kaiju. What can we do about it? And in nearly every single one, someone will eventually say, oh, maybe we should use a hydrogen bomb. And someone says, no, we can never do that. And then that's it. It's never, ever mentioned ever again. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like you said, Minus One, obviously it's in that time frame that that has happened. So it's, yeah, it's fantastic.
Yeah.
Another question about your career. So your credit on all the Mondo releases, I'm guessing they will just endure forever. So those credits will remain as they are?
Yeah. For those who don't know, I recently left Mondo about a year ago now. And as of recording this, and it's we're all good. You know, me and my partner Spencer, who I co-ran the label with for a decade, we decided we wanted to like do our own thing, which is all good. But we really wanted that catalog to endure. You know, we made like 500 soundtrack albums over there. It's kind of crazy to think about it in that volume. I mean, you can see behind me, I have this is just some of them, right? Like you have a Kallax, you know, behind you, but this is like a custom piece of furniture that has two rows behind it. And so this is every single Mondo catalog album, which goes up to about 300. And then over here is mostly every Death Waltz record.
Yeah.
And combined with that, it's about 500 releases, you know, and, you know, many of them are out of print and probably will never be printed again because of union limitations and, you know, things that got tricky and thorny after the fact. You know, after every merger, there's like a big purge of things that are just impenetrable. Like we did the Buffy the Vampire Slayer musical episode once and we did it and it was amazing. And then now they like right before I was leaving, I remember Mondo being like, can we make more of those? And I asked, you know, Disney, and Disney were like, we have no idea how this works because we just bought Fox and we were just sort of give us some time to figure this out. No. So to answer your initial question, of course. I mean, I felt always weird crediting myself. I look at some labels and what they do and how they credit themselves now, and I think it's cool, and I think people who work on these records should be credited, and we always were very conscious of crediting the actual illustrator. But as far as like putting my name on things, I by the end and for the last maybe like 5-6 years, I was basically had my hand on every single package. I was designing and doing layout and doing a lot of stuff, so I would credit myself for those things. But like in essence, I guess I was technically producing a reissue every single time I did it. And so if my name was on there previously, it should stay, but I don't really know if they would do that, change anything.
And I'm guessing because some of these releases take so long to come out to gestate and eventually see the light of day, that your name might still be on yours and Spencer's names might still be on future Mondo releases.
Yeah, like I said, we left the company last summer, and to date, there has only been one release that they have put out that was not just in the hopper for me and Spencer when we were working. So they're still working through that catalog. I think they're almost done. They just released this album that we worked on towards the end called Garcia.
Yep.
By Eugenio Mira, who was the director of a film called Grand Piano, and he got to work on this HBO Max miniseries called Garcia, based on a Spanish graphic novel. And he did this amazing eight episode miniseries that went like wildly underseen. But Eugenio is a dear friend of mine, and he's like so incredibly creative because, and if you watch the show, you may notice that it doesn't say film by, music by Eugenio Mira, because he's very self-conscious. Uh-huh. Like as I'm talking about myself, saying crediting myself, he credits a fake name for it, but no, he writes all of his own music as well. Sorry to out him like this, but he writes all of his own music and he directed every episode. Wow. And so like there's just so much work that went into it, and that was such a, it was such an amazing piece of work that I wanted to celebrate it. And Alan Hines, who's an artist we worked with on a number of projects, he also worked on Grand Piano with us, which is another Eugenio Mira piece. If you've never seen the movie Grand Piano, there is a composition in the film. It's a film about a pianist played by Elijah Wood, who is being held at a sniper rifle gunpoint to play a perfect concert or else he will assassinate him. And it's really high concept. It's basically speed on a piano, right? Yeah. And it's just as fun and campy and clever as that sounds. But he has to play this piece called The Impossible Piece, and it is insane. And that's Eugenio playing it on the piano, right? And so it's like things like that. So we had Alan Hines design a single for the La Cinquette, is what it's called, The Impossible Piece, or The Unplayable Piece, maybe I'm misspeaking. And I wanted to continue that through line, so I had Alan work on this package. Sorry, this is such a tangent.
No, it's good.
And he developed this piece of artwork, and it was right as we were going out the door. And I remember being like, okay, bye, I'll see you later, project. And I hadn't thought about it in a couple of months. And then just like a few weeks ago, I saw the first photo of it. And I was like, oh my God, it's real. And I got my first copy of it just a few days ago. And it turned out so good. It's like, I'm so proud of it. Like everyone I showed it to are just like losing their minds. And I'm like, oh my God, like it is crazy. Like there's still things that are coming out that like, you know, I tumbled a little snowball up the top of the mountain and now it's like an avalanche down here. So it's cool. It's the gift that keeps on giving in a way. You know, there are things that I worked on that will be forever in print, you know, like Over the Garden Wall, which is a soundtrack to a Cartoon Network miniseries that I'm so proud of, but like that now is like a perennial favorite. And so I just happy that will be in press forever. And it's very exciting to me.
Well, congratulations on Mutant. I mean, I'm sure it can't be an easy thing to go and set up your own company. But it sounds like, you know, going back to metaphors, it's a little bit like Jerry Maguire and you and Spencer are Tom Cruise and Renee Zellweger. I don't know who's who in that relationship. But it sounds like
I think I'm Renee. You know.
But it sounds like you've got all these relationships with all the studios and all the different labels and all the composers and it sounds like you're just going to go from strength to strength to strength. So you've already put out the Dune 2 soundtrack, which I've pre-ordered. I've not got it yet. Yeah. Fall Guy came out this week, and it's just, I mean, it's fantastic, right?
Yeah. No, Jerry Maguire is an apt metaphor. But not to assign some weird evil disposition to our former company. You know, we weren't fired, right? Yep. Me and Spencer, some of my other coworkers were laid off, and that was unfortunate. And corporate machinations aside, the ethos is that, you know, to keep the metaphor going, Jerry Maguire wakes up one morning and decides like, what if things were a little bit smaller? That way we can pay a little more attention to how things are going.
Yep.
And he writes this memo, the infamous memo. We didn't do that. We just felt in our hearts that it was time to dial it down. We are very fortunate that people have trusted us over the years and continue to trust us. We told all our partners that we were leaving and that we may be starting up something again sometime soon. And a lot of those people want to keep working with us. And, you know, we were very lucky that there was a couple of projects coming up that needed some work. And so we took them on. This was things like Lisa Frankenstein and Driveaway Dolls, a project that we were planning on getting started on, you know, back when the movie was supposed to come out last September and then ended up coming out being pushed back because of the strikes, right?
Yeah.
And there was a couple of things that like worked out in our favor, to our benefit, to like have a little extra runway, working on Michael Giacchino's Society of the Snow. And Dune, as you mentioned, we decided we were told we can work on Dune 2, and then the movie got pushed to March, and so it ended up being perfect amount of timing for us to go behind the scenes and work a little bit more to get our company set up for it. But we're incredibly lucky. Every single partner we've had along the way has been so generous with their time and their catalog, and they're, you know, trusting us with their trust. You know, like we don't take it for granted. It's a really, really special and privileged position to be in, and we just try to honor it on every release and make sure we're making the best possible thing and making the filmmakers happy.
Beautiful. I've not got it yet, but my buddy Tom, who's a composer here in New Zealand, just picked up Society of the Snow the other day.
Oh,
so
cool.
It's Mutant is already represented in New Zealand Records stores.
Oh,
which is nice.
That's surreal. That's crazy.
It is, yeah.
That's very exciting. That's very exciting. I love that score. You know, I was talking to someone at the Lost event, and they compared the Society of Snow score to Lost, and at first I was sort of like, oh, that's crazy. You know, I had that thought, but I didn't want to say that in like a reductive way, because it sounds like, oh, it means he's repeating himself. But actually, I mean that in the most powerful way.
Yeah.
It's actually has a really, really emotional through line that I haven't felt since Lost. You know, like people obviously are shattered to tears anytime Michael plays like Married Life or, you know, the real weepy stuff. But like his themes from Lost are so good. And those are 20 years old, you know, and 20 years later, he had another plane crash, you know, a story about a plane crash. And there is
never thought of that link. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And he had this like haunting melody that he used to tie it all together that like feels really almost complementary to some of the Lost stuff. Because Lost also has a lot of sci-fi and a lot of like jungle music and a lot of like, you know, atypical instrumentation, like percussion that's being banged on actual fuselage and stuff like that. This is missing from that. But like the emotional core of it, melodies, very similar haunting melodies to Lost that are very powerful. And so if you like the score for Lost, I highly recommend checking out The Society of Snow.
Nice. Back to you and your movies. Who's your favorite actor?
Actor? You know, I don't know that I have a single favorite actor. I will say, oh, pardon me, my cat's here. I will say that if there's a, maybe not favorite, but an actor that I know if he's in a project, it's going to be worth checking out, is Tom Cruise.
Yeah.
I learned this very early on, basically that like he only chooses movies that are interesting and he makes them interesting. And so for better or for worse, you know, name above the title, capital S star Tom Cruise only worked with the best of the best filmmakers for the first 30 years of his career. Not saying that he's not doing that currently, but now he's a little much after like the couch jumping thing. He's definitely in a like apology tour, I only do franchise stuff type of stuff now. I'm waiting for the next era of Tom where he gets back to making weird movies. But and not to say that I don't like the Mission Impossible movies. I obviously love the Mission Impossible movies. But like from 1984 or whatever until 2007, you know, War of the Worlds or whatever, like every single movie he made during that run is worth checking out. Like
fully
have not been disappointed by checking out a single one of those movies.
There's a tweet that's one of my most retweeted tweets. I did mention this in my last episode, so I do apologize to my listeners, but this bears repeating. So I always retweet this when people say, oh, Tom Cruise, he's not a good actor. He's just a movie star, blah, 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 blah. So, and this is exactly what you said. Incredibly, Tom Cruise worked with all these directors over a 20-year period. Coppola, 83. Ridley Scott, 85. Tony Scott, 86. Scorsese, 86. Levinson, 88. Oliver Stone, 89, Ron Howard, 92, Rob Reiner, 92, Sidney Pollack, 93, Brian De Palma, 96, Cameron Crowe, 96, Stanley Kubrick, 99, Paul Thomas Anderson, 99, John Woo, 2000, and Spielberg, 2002. It's just incredible.
Yeah.
And then just after that, you've got Michael Mann as well. You know,
It's
crazy. Absolutely crazy.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, look, do I think every single one of those movies is perfect? No. You know, there's a couple of movies in there that are not, that are like, again, but I think they're all interesting. And I think that is the power of the movie star. Like, I think both things can be true, right? He is an actor that I trust, and he's also a movie star, and he sells movies. And that's like what's being lost in this era a little bit.
Yeah.
The fact that there aren't a lot of actors that you can just go and be like, I don't know what this thing is, but I trust this person, so I'm going to go see it. You know, like I think Keanu has a little bit of that now, but Keanu is similarly in sort of action mode and has been for a little bit. But Keanu also made a lot of interesting choices, again, good or bad. Like he was always making choices. So yeah, I mean, now it's back. Now it's back to being filmmaker based. But there used to be a time where there was a couple of actors. You'd be like, I know that they're going to do something. They're always going to pick the most interesting project that's in front of them.
Perfect. Tom Cruise is mentioned a lot on this podcast, and I just love it every time his name comes up because I'm just in love with the guy. He's fantastic. Social media. So you're not on social media quite a lot. You're on Instagram, but I think you're not on Facebook and you're not on Twitter.
I deleted my Facebook at the height of the like delete Facebook movement, you know, whether or not that was a hollow stance or not. I kind of believed it at the time that I didn't need it. It was kind of becoming this place where I wasn't checking it as much and it was just making everyone angry. So I decided to go away and I decided to put a little bit of that energy into Twitter, which was something that I was barely using at the time. I'm not witty and I'm not fast. And so Twitter is not my preferred social media platform. But then Twitter became like what I think, you know, over the last 5 years, it was a place I got really addicted to, like just kind of scrolling or doom scrolling. Right.
Yep.
And I found myself really not enjoying it. So when Elon bought it, that was a clean out for me. So I was like, all right, I'm going to push pause on this. Who knows how long Instagram has for me. I don't think I'll do TikTok. Yeah. But I do need, I need something,
one thing
to keep me relevant. So Instagram is working. And I feel most people probably agree with this ideology, which is that like, it's not about like, there are some people who need social media for like entertainment. I think a lot of people just need it for connection. I'm fortunate that I have a pretty good community here in Austin, and good resources for news and other stuff. But like, I miss so much the days, the weeks that I'm a slightly absent from social media. Yeah. You know, I think about just this morning we were on a call and Eric, my coworker, was like, oh, new Kendrick Lamar, you know, diss track just dropped. And I was like, where did you see this? And and you know, he was on More on the Draw. Like I wouldn't know that until we get off this podcast because I haven't been able to look online. You know, I've just been in the zone working for the last couple hours. So like same, you know, there are people who get all their news in the main arteries and then disseminate. So I that's my stance on social media. I'm not firm and hard against any of the one platforms, but like I know what bums me out and what like ruins my day. And Instagram does the least of that at the moment. So
I did the reason I ask is I did wonder if that a part of that was because of sometimes the childish nature of record collectors. You know, it can be like Spencer does try and like, you know, stand up sometimes. And I think sometimes, you know, these storms come and go, but I'm thinking of things like the,
the groups, right?
Yeah.
I mean, look, I think, you know, divide and conquer has always been our mentality, me and Spence. There's definitely plenty of stuff that I do that he doesn't. But he's already a part of those groups. And he at one point was like, don't look into the eye of Sauron. I will take care. I know you're not on this, but I will take care of this. But I've also found, and this, you know, is not necessarily a further invitation of it, but like I, on like places like Instagram, I'm very accessible. My platform is public, right? And I answer questions that come to me. If anyone messages me with a question, I'm very quick to answer. I have no problem. I'm actually pretty honest and diplomatic about a lot of things. And people a lot of times just want to know that they're heard and want to answer. And I feel like the forums are that, but they are a far deeper well of cynicism.
Yep.
And just any like honest critiques or concerns.
Yeah.
So like when I look at some of those platforms, they are just actually questions in the form of a takedown.
Yeah.
You know, like a lot of times they're just sort of like if they're just like, why did this happen? You know, you can answer that question honestly, which sometimes is like, it sucks. Sometimes these things happen, like something's misprints happen or, you know, in production, this didn't turn out the way you wanted it to, or last minute, we had to make this change or something like that. And, you know, instead people go to their own communities and they vent as if they think that no one is hearing them or listening to them. And I've always found that like 99% of the time people are actually listening and they just like the corporate machine above them will refuses to let them acknowledge it because it makes them seem like weak. I don't know what that means, but like, this is another reason why being a small company is actually kind of interesting, because if someone were to come to us and say like, this thing didn't work or this is broken, then we'd be able to respond in real time and be like, that is great feedback. This happened, or we can at least explain ourselves a little bit. But it, you know, the forums are a sort of a interesting place to spend too much time on. I do invite people, if they have any questions, to reach out to either myself or Spencer or anyone in the Mutants for now about concerns. We try to address them in real time. Obviously, not just like, where's my record? I can't really answer. But yeah, I can generally update people on where things are, you know.
I tapped out of the, I'm still in a couple of those groups, but I tapped out mentally myself when Mondo did those Halloween reissues for the box set maybe 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah.
And the whole debacle about the cover art for the first film, that people were like abusing the artist online, saying, oh, you know, that doesn't happen in the film. Why have you put that in there? But, you know, like, Live and Let Die the poster of Live and Let Die has a speedboat being shot out of the mouth of an alligator. That doesn't happen in the film either. It, you know, art is art. And I remember Spencer getting quite, you know, in the trenches then, you know, trying to defend. And I just take everything people say in those worlds with a pinch of salt.
Yeah, literalism is a bit of a curse. And I get it to some degree. You know, there's a little bit of this controversy now with the Civil War posters that were just out there that were AI generated. And I saw a lot of people being like, yeah, AI, but this also doesn't happen in the film.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, I think those are two different arguments here. Like, the AI thing is one thing, but also their decision to interpret their film and market it in a different way is theirs, you know. Like, the key art of that movie is Statue of Liberty, you know, with like soldiers in the torch, right? And that doesn't happen in the film, but no one really seems to care about that. It is just like, I think, again, some people can look at things objectively and not criticize them. But then now that they've seen the film, they can be like, oh, further additional things that come out after it. I've seen the film. I know what it is. It's not that.
Yeah.
And that's also sort of an unfair limitation to put on things. Also, and I mean this as lovingly as possible, horror film fans are very a singular breed in a both a good and also frighteningly devoted way.
Yeah.
That, like, I love the passion. I think it can be misplaced sometimes, but generally I think that it is a force for good and can be, except for the literalism that tends to come along with the sort of devotional nature to this stuff.
Fantastic. Mo Shafiq, do you have a favorite director?
Oh, this one's easy. The Wachowskis.
Really?
Yeah.
For some reason, I thought you were going to say Cameron Crowe.
I do love Cameron. I adore his films. I think they're really special. But you know what? No, the Wachowskis.
Nice.
For a similar reason, you know, I think Cameron's work is so incredibly, nakedly, achingly sincere. And I apply the same thing to the Wachowskis.
Yeah.
I think Lana and Lily have just been making nakedly earnest movies, but they're genre exercises. They are just true artists that are making one-of-a-kind singular pieces of art, and I love everything that they've ever made.
I'm guessing you would have worked alongside Lana for the Resurrections release that you did last year. Was it Lana or Lily? Was it Lana or Lily that did Resurrections?
It was Lana.
Lana, yeah.
Lana. Yes, it all went to Lana for approvals. There are some projects that I get looped in on emails and I get to see my fave's email addresses and smile and go like, oh, that's so weird. I'm on an email thread with this person. This is so weird. And also their email address is so generic. It's so strange. But then, unfortunately I was never truly looped in with Lana. I know that she saw it. I know she approved it. I know that Tom Teichberg and Johnny Klimek also were involved very actively. But sadly, I was not directly in communication with her. I think that that's, look, as much as I would, I was almost on a call with Lily actually a couple of weeks ago. That was also really surreal. I was like, this is so weird. I'm about to be on a call. And then very last minute, she couldn't make it. But it was, I mean, I'm not necessarily like aching to meet anyone that is my idol or someone who I'm obsessed with, I get so incredibly, you know, nervous about embarrassing myself. And even if I was like, you know, on that call, I would never mention even once that I was like some geeky fan or whatever. But you know, I have to my right, you can't see it, it's off camera, but I bought from Lana and Lily's, warehouse sale, their storage unit sale that they donated stuff to auction. I bought this giant 7 foot tall Cloud Atlas prop that is in the corner of my office.
What every house needs.
Yes, exactly. Hashtag real fan. I'm also the world's biggest Matrix sequels defender. And I've have been that. For over 15 years.
Yeah.
And so there is a lot of that that goes into it. And I think that what they, in getting back to the genre as metaphor thing, I think that the films of the Wachowskis are some of the best of that breed. Whether it's a trans allegory, anti-capitalist allegory, an anti-dogma allegory, I think it's all really, really important, and they've done it all. And it's very, very interesting to see them operate in this space that is so commercial and to limited success after their first big break. Yep. But all the at-bats they've had are all special and all really, really important, I think. And I hope that they get to make more big budget films. I fear that they won't.
Yeah, yeah.
But even if they didn't, they had like 7 at-bats and they are all really great.
Yeah. Two quick things. I want to loop back to the Wachowskis shortly, but just going back to meeting your heroes, last weekend I was in the mall, a local mall, with my daughter in a store, and Taika Waititi walked in.
Now, oh, hell yeah.
This does not happen in New Zealand. I know New Zealand is a small country, but this is not a common thing. And he walked in and I thought, should I say hello? And I just didn't because, yeah, time and place, you know what I mean?
Sure. Yeah, no, exactly. You know, it's always hard. I feel like there are some famous people who handle that very well,
yeah,
as long as it is just a, hey, trying to interrupt, just want to tell you, big fan, you know.
Yeah.
There are some people who will take photos with you. I think it's hard when it becomes, oh, now you're drawing attention to me. Other people want to know what's going on, right? So
yeah.
I'm fortunate. I've met Taika a handful of times, many times in like a very, at film festivals, right? And he's really, really sweet person. And I think that environment at least invited a sort of a like,
sure,
yeah, let's chat, whatever. Yeah. We're talking movies, you know, that kind of thing. But yeah, I guess if I ever saw anyone with their family,
he was like with his kids. And I thought, no, it's not the right place. Going back to the Wachowskis, last year I saw a screening of Bound, which I'd not seen. I did actually see Bound before I saw The Matrix, but mm-hmm. I'd never seen it since. And I was blown away by all the things in Bound that then appeared in The Matrix. So the suits, the style, the fetishization of like rotary telephones and dialing tones and things like that. I was so blown away. And I remember because I saw it in the cinema in 96 or 97, whenever it came out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I remember being so excited because Gina Gershon was in it. And you know, she was like the pinup at the time. And then on this watch, I just could not believe like Meg Tilly, how like erotic she is. Like I was like, you know, bowled over. That's Jennifer Tilly, Johnny, not Meg Tilly. Although I don't think I'd realized until now that Meg Tilly and Jennifer Tilly are two different people. And they're sisters. But what a film that is. And what a debut that is.
And Joe Pantoliano, absolute out of control performer. I wish that Joey Pantoliano was in every single Wachowski film. You know, like I wish that was like their ringer.
Yeah.
I wish he was in Speed Racer at some point, you know. you know, it's I haven't seen it in about like, I don't know, I want to say like a decade, but I already pre-ordered the Criterion 4K, so that'll be coming in June, I think. I'm excited to revisit that.
Yeah.
And look at it from that perspective. I hadn't really thought about it. But yeah, I mean, I always resented that, like, the little mini movement of people being like, the Wachowskis stole The Matrix from some comic creator or whatever, right? And I'm like, we're all inspired by the same things.
<That's right.
laughs> Ideas exist in a, like, plagiarism does exist, but also we are a hive mind of a community of people who are all raised on the same things. People get to the same places at the same time.
Mo, do you have, and this is an odd question to ask due to your occupation, do you have a favorite soundtrack or score?
Oh, this is tough. An all-time favorite soundtrack or score. That's really hard. Yeah. I'll say soundtrack because it was such an important moment in my life, and I feel like that it's sort of solidified a few things about what I feel my place in this world. I don't think a single film soundtrack has been more important to my life than the Josie and the Pussycat soundtrack. Well, he looks at me with those innocent eyes and says it looks like you're wearing some kind of disguise because your hair sticks up, your shoes are untied. I hope that you got that shirt out of blood. And for those who are not aware, in 2000, Deborah Kaplan and Harry Alphont directed a satire of the MTV TRL generation called Josie and the Pussycats, with songs written and performed by Kay Hanley and Michael Eisen. I'm forgetting on his last name, but from Letters to Cleo, along with people like Adam Duritz, Adam Schlesinger, rest in peace, a bit naked, Babyface, and made this collection of 10 amazing pop punk pop songs, like MTV Blink-182 era pop songs that, and also created the music of a fictional boy band modeled after, NSYNC and Backstreet Boys called Du Jour, and created this like incredible universe that, I fell in love with in 2000. Me and my friends saw it twice opening weekend, fell in love with it. And we were just mortified to find out that people didn't get it, didn't like it. It was incredible for us. We were like, this is brilliant. Like, especially being a little bit of music snobs back in the day, and sort of similarly having a very similar feeling of what is selling out in 1999 or 2000 in the TRL era, when you follow your favorite band Blink-182 from being indie darling to as big as Britney Spears.
Yeah.
It was top of mind and everything. And it just captured the zeitgeist of an era of time that I feel like people are not aware of, because this is a little mini tangent, but I remember it dawning on me when I saw the movie Pop Star, the Andy Samberg, Akiva and, Yorma Lonely Island film, where, Andy Samberg's character says quite blanketly, he's like, no one cares about selling out anymore. In fact, people will question why you haven't sold out anymore. Yeah. And that was like meant as a joke, but it was actually a really faithful read of the change of times in the early 2000s, which is that like everyone has a brand deal. It's no longer weird anymore. Like, but in the late 90s, we were just coming off of like peak sellout culture. And, Josie is such an interesting time capsule in that regard. But the reason it's so important, why it's my favorite, or why it's, I guess, the most significant thing in my life, is because I was a part of a reunion getting the filmmakers and the cast and the band back together. And I got to like play a part in getting Kay Hanley and Adam Schlesinger and the band that actually recorded the Josie and the Pussycats album live on stage in Los Angeles to like reunite and play those songs for the very first time to a sold out audience of people who had been like diehard dieting for this thing. Right. And seeing the reaction to this thing. And I was like, oh, if no one does this, then it just doesn't happen.
Yeah.
And that's like been my mentality around physical media in general, which is just like, I was a fan of this. I willed this thing into existence because I just wanted it to exist for myself. And then I accidentally made this thing happen for everyone else. And now it exists. And it's crazy that that's how life works.
Yeah.
And that's how filmmaking works. I always wanted to be a filmmaker, but it never really ended up happening. But like, I feel like being adjacent and being a fan of film and being able to push these things over the finish line sometimes is going to be my legacy. And so that soundtrack is now coming up on almost 25 years, is rapidly approaching a really far more influential part of my life than I expected.
Nice. Lovely. Lovely answer. Do you have a favorite cinema?
20 years ago, I would have been really proud to say this, and not that I am not proud to say this, but it's a little more mainstream than it used to be. But man, the first time I went to an Alamo Drafthouse, back when I was on tour, it just melted my brain. I was on the road going to Austin every now and then with some bands, and saw a movie at the Alamo in Austin, and I was just like, I had no idea it could be like this.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, I haven't been to a ton of cinemas outside of LA, New York, and Austin, and so and this is going to offend somebody, I'm sure, but I think that theaters in Los Angeles are generally not great. I think that people who live there are very fortunate that there's a lot of really great rep screenings, because that's where the industry is, and so there's a lot of great screenings there, but the theaters aren't great. And I've been to too many screenings where people just cannot put their phones away and do not care about the theatrical experience, that I sadly feel like at this point the best, like I used to call Alamo Drafthouse a church. You know, it was like a place where I could worship in peace. And I feel like, you know, with some limited exception of the occasional bad screening that is just, you know, bound to happen anywhere, I've been really fortunate in that, like, I can rely on the presentation and the peace of mind of going to an Alamo Drafthouse screening, regardless of if it's opening night or like an empty screening of, you know, with two other people, that is a one of a kind experience. Not a one of a kind experience, but like at least a very optimal experience, theatrical experience. I will choose reliability over, you know, I guess authentic, you know, uncomfortable seats in an art house theater that is, you know, legendary and 100 years old, right? That's probably my hot take.
Do you know the link between the Alamo Drafthouse and Auckland, New Zealand?
No, I don't.
So the cinema I go to a lot, which is my favorite cinema, plays a lot of 35 mil prints, is the Hollywood Avondale, it's called. That's owned by Matt Timpson, who is the brother of Ant Timpson.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Who I'm sure you'll know. So Turbo Kid,
I know Ant,
ABCs of Death, etc. So Ant and Matt, between them, own the largest collection of 35 mil prints in the Southern Hemisphere, which, you know, it's not the Northern Hemisphere, but it's still a pretty big collection. Half of their collection is at the Alamo Drafthouse.
Mm-hmm.
And the other
AGFA, huh?
And the other half is here, and I think they're thinking about switching them over at some point. So a lot of those, if you've been to the Alamo Drafthouse and seen some of the 35 mil prints, it would have been some of Ant's, probably.
There Fun fact,
yeah.
I own 2 35 millimeter prints, and they're for The Matrix Reloaded and The Matrix Revolutions.
Nice.
So if you've seen a 35 millimeter print of The Matrix Reloaded or Revolutions at an Alamo Drafthouse, it's probably been my 35 millimeter prints, because I donated them to AGFA.
Nice. Fantastic. Do you have a controversial movie opinion?
Like in general, or like about a specific film?
Anything. I mean, usually this sort of question sort of engenders the sorts of things like, oh, I don't like Star Wars, you know, that, which is not really controversial anymore, but, you know.
Yeah. I don't know that I do. I think that there's like, it's not really a controversial take, but I do think that there is a sociological, sorry, my cat is making a lot of noises. There's a lot of, a direct correlation between people's opinions and the subject matter of them, of a film. Specifically, and the thesis I'm working on is about movies about failure. I think that there's a lot of really great movies about failure that people, that general audiences hate.
Yeah.
And one of those movies is The Last Jedi. And I think that that movie being about failing and the importance of failure is what repulses people more than the actual subject matter or story or plot of what happens to any characters in that movie.
Yeah.
I think that movie, even if no one died or anything, whatever, like any specific plot detail didn't happen, I think the overall theme of failure as inevitable and lesson is inherently unattractive to people. Another movie that I feel is similar is Wonder Woman 1984. This may be my controversial opinion. That movie is good. That movie is actually better than the first one, and maybe the only really truly interesting superhero movie to come out in the last 5 to 6 years, because it is a movie about failure. It's also a movie about Trump. You know, like, it's a movie about a lot of things, and like, I feel like general audiences cannot hang sometimes with movies that confront them with their own bad faith reconciliation of situations. And, you know, kudos to the people behind that film for making a movie that was about, like, well, you can't be mad at him and not be mad at yourself for believing the American dream, which is a lie. You know, like, that is what that movie is about, and it has a sci-fi premise for some reason that people cannot get over. Like, they can't be like, a wishing rock, that just is insane, you know, like. And I'm like, like, you know, whatever, the people like rules and whatever, and some people, for some reason, that movie explicitly, there, everyone was like super tripped up on the rules, and I cannot for the life of me figure out why the rules of that movie do not work for them, other than my thesis that failure just is a thing that people immediately get turned off by, and they want triumph, they want the hero to win, they don't want the hero to lose or learn a lesson. That is not what the hero's journey is to them. And so it is a, it's advanced storytelling. And I think that that is not what the average American or worldwide audience wants out of a movie.
I also find that casual moviegoers will think, if they don't like the ending of a film, they'll think that the film is bad. So Leave the World Behind, that came out over Christmas. You know, I loved that. But all of the casual movie fans I saw, I spoke to about it, they hated it. Why did you hate it? Oh, that ending. She just gets into a bunker and puts friends on. Oh, terrible film. And, you know, No Country for Old Men is another one, which I absolutely love. People don't like it because there's a little bit of dialogue at the end, which is straight from the Cormac McCarthy novel, where Tommy Lee Jones is saying, I had a dream about my father. He saw some guy fixing to make a fire. I love that. I just love it. But people say, oh, terrible film. Oh, didn't like it, you know. Get over it.
Endings, endings are a big thing. I mean, we can go on and on about endings, especially when we were starting this conversation about Lost, but I think that people forget how good of an experience they had week to week with Lost, and have since thrown it away in their minds because they don't like the ending. Meanwhile, the experience of 5 years of joy they got from it,
that's right,
hinging on whether or not they like the last hour of something, is so strange to me.
And sorry, one last thing about Lost. That last season episode that's all in Portuguese between the two characters, I love that episode. That's probably my all-time favorite episode.
I love season 6 of Lost. I mean, this is my controversial take. I think the season 6 of Lost is incredibly underrated. I think that is operating on a fully thematic level, to bring it full circle to the thing that I was talking about at the top, which is, you know, sci-fi or genre as metaphor. I have never been more in the zone with what they were thematically on with that last season than I've ever been with anything. Like, the rest of the show is kind of messy. I get it. It's sort of a weird sci-fi tropey thing, but like, season 6, they were like, this is what the show is about. And I was like, I'm all in on this, and I get what this is, and I love it.
You said earlier that you don't really have a favorite genre anymore. What don't you like in terms of movies?
Insincerity. I posturing, you know, like, here's a good sort of example of that. Like, I like a movie that is accidentally bad, because I don't believe in, I think that if you like a movie, you like a movie, regardless of if you like it for its flaws or not. Like, I don't think there's anything such as a guilty pleasure. I think that, like, you know, what's that movie that Fred Durst from Limp Bizkit directed with John Travolta? That was him as a serial stalker, where he, like, the kidnaps fan? Devin Sawa. What?
The Fan, is it? Is it The Fan?
Yeah, The Fan or The Fanatic or something like that, right? I had the time of my life watching that movie. I wouldn't say it's a good movie, but, like, it is so insane. And I had so much fun watching it. And to me, that means it was a successful movie, right? Whether or not I considered it a quality, right? Because that movie was sincere. Every choice John Travolta was making, sincere. Everything behind the camera, sincere. It was not made in bad faith. Now, there are movies, and this, you know, maybe this is another, I'm sorry to keep hypothesizing that this is the hottest take I'm going to have, that there are a lot of people who love the Fast and the Furious movies. And I think those movies can be fun, but I largely think those movies are very insincere. I think those movies have leaned into the memification of themselves to a point where they have fundamentally broken what people found joy in them from when they kind of became popular again with Part 4 and Part 5, right? Like, they were these, like, macho soap opera things that were, like, strange objects that like were so sincere, but like by now they are just not even parodies, but they are like, they are leaning into what they think that people want yep. out of soap operas, and you can't do that and also be sincere. It's just very strange. So yeah, I think I don't like insincerity.
The Fast and Furious films, I want to put a supercut together of all the little scenes where they have a beer together. That's like one of the yeah. tropes that they always go back to. Hey, you want a beer? And then like the you know, they're sipping on Coronas or
Coronas,
whatever.
Yeah.
All right, big question to come. I just want to ask one last question about Mutant. Yeah. So I've got a shout out to the Movie Wax group on Facebook, who are the nicest bunch of record collectors. So the admins, they are your own, Glenn and Ryan. And mm-hmm. they would kill me if I didn't ask you this question. So what's Mutant got lined up for the future? Can you give me any exclusives? Is it true that you guys are going to put out the Challengers score?
Oh, sorry, my cat. I'm learning that when I do podcasts, my cat should still be asleep at this point.
What's your cat called?
I think when I'm Meatloaf.
Oh, Meatloaf. Oh, father of Meatloaf. That makes sense.
And when I'm talking a lot, he wakes up and I think he thinks I'm talking to him. And I'm not, but I wish yeah. I was.
Hello, Meatloaf.
No challengers, not yet anyway. Already score of the year for me, yeah, frankly. I adore
fantastic.
It. But we, Milan, who have the digital rights, I believe they don't do a lot of their own physical releases. Very seldom do they actually press their own stuff. They usually sublicense to labels like us, but this one, I think they know they have.
Yeah. And it's got
they
to,
know what they have.
It has to come out, doesn't it? I mean, somebody was saying the other day that the last couple of Reznor Ross scores have not come out on physical vinyl.
Yeah.
This has to.
Bones and All has never come out. Mutant Mayhem has not come out.
Yeah.
Both films that I would love to work on, frankly, but, at the moment I wished we just worked on Shogun, which is not Reznor, but it's Ross and sure. his brother Leopold Ross yep. and Nick Chuba. And any number of these projects I would love to, but you know, they also do a lot of their own pressing. So I'm actually kind of surprised that Milan are doing it themselves, because whenever their soundtrack doesn't have a physical release, I always assume that like in a year and a half that on the Nullcore, their own web store, that they're going to have like they did with Social Network or Mank or any of those, like that they're going to do it themselves.
Yeah.
Cause they, yeah, Watchmen. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yep. Oh my God. Those are great. But no, anything coming down the line that I can tease or reveal? Well, we're working on Furiosa, which
nice.
Is really exciting. You know, me and Spencer got to work on Fury Road. We got to work on 3,000 Years of Longing, a criminally underrated film. And you know, Tom Hulkenberg, a lot of Tom Hulkenberg stuff. And so we're just excited that we get to work on this one. The score is great. If you like the score to Fury Road, you will also like the score to Furiosa. Sorry, I slowed down there. I just found myself tripping up on the words Road or Furiosa. But yeah. Another thing that we can talk about, it's not just casually, I'm trying to think if there's anything else that sort of the people want to know. Again, I'm not on the forum, so I don't know what the people are demanding, but we're getting back into some Marvel stuff, which I know some people who have been collecting the some past work of ours at our previous company may want some new Marvel stuff, and so we'll be doing some of that, as well as you know, a few other Disney adjacent stuff and all the franchises that that entails. We have some stuff like that on the horizon. And we have a lot of Michael Giacchino stuff coming out this year as we put out a 7-inch this weekend in Honolulu. And on the package, there's a not a teaser, an explicit admission of an album to come. Yep. That we are going to start talking about pretty soon. But if you like that 7-inch, and which digitally will be released this month, and when that comes out, we can start talking a little bit more about what that project actually is.
Will Mutant be doing more new things rather than retro things? Is that the plan?
You know, when we started, we assumed it would be a little bit more of an even mix,
right?
But we are, you know, it's funny to take your foot off the gas for a second and then immediately get passed by, and not in a bad way. We had done so many, like I said, 500, you know, soundtracks and scores over the many years. There's not a lot of catalog left to pursue. I mean, obviously there's thousands of films, but you know, of seminal classics, of essentials, right? And so we were so fortunate that we got to work on so many things, and at the same time, while we were doing that, so many of our, you know, contemporaries were also putting out labels. So like the 10 soundtrack labels that are out there all were working in tandem to put out this incredible vast library of things that have existed now, that now you name it and it's been on vinyl. Yeah. And if it hasn't, then it's very likely that it's tied up in some sort of trickiness. There's a handful of things that we really want to do that are in the catalog stuff. Spencer has a catalog title coming out this month at a horror convention that will be coming out pretty soon. And he has a handful of titles that he's working on, not to segment the work that way. I just mean that like he was very quick to be like, oh, we have this, I want to do this project over here.
Yeah.
Early on, and we have it. It's really cool. And I think that, you know, we'll probably balance the scales, but I do think it'll probably be closer to 70-30 than it used to be.
Sure.
Mondo was probably a little more 30-70,
yeah.
You know, with new releases and catalog stuff. And now it's going to be mostly new releases. But that's because, you know, like I said, it's interesting what the studios want from us, which is, again, it's hard to, you know, predict what people are going to want and what they're going to like. But you know for a fact that a filmmaker is going to want some form of physical media for their thing.
Yeah.
And we just try to pick the movies we like the most. We were so fortunate that we got to do, you know, the first Omen, which is a movie that I absolutely adored. Wonka, which is so good. Society of the Snow, Dune Part 2. You know, you hope that everything that you like and that you work on is something that people are going to care about. But I also believe in a lot of these things are going to have their legacies over time. Lisa Frankenstein already feels like a cult classic, and I'm so glad that we got to work on that, you know, when we did. So, and I think that's cool. I also, a big thing for us is we want to work with, you know, a diverse amount of filmmakers and composers. And the problem with working backwards is there's not a lot in the well, you know, from the 80s and 90s and 70s, you know, yep. It's all kind of the same people. So in a perfect world, you know, working with a more diverse amount of filmmakers and composers that have different voices and different, you know, sonic profiles and things like that.
Sure. A couple of episodes ago, I spoke to Tarquin Gotch, who is, you know, that was another dream come true. So that I'm sure you know, but the music supervisor for John Hughes.
Yeah.
And then I also then spoke to Ron Payne, the other music supervisor for John Hughes, the episode or a couple of episodes later. So that box set that they came out with year before last, Life Moves Pretty Fast. It's so good.
Yeah.
And I asked Tarquin, you know, what are the chances of seeing future John Hughes reissues? And he said, oh, you know, we spoke to Demon Records, who put that box set out, and the general feeling is that, you know, it's that box set is it, that, you know, we won't get any more. But still, you know, Ferris Bueller, there's no official physical release. Things
I got
like
a bootleg of it, but yeah. I don't have a
things like this.
Yeah.
Airplane, mm-hmm. I got last week. People are still buying these things, and I just, mm-hmm. you know, please put out the Ferris Bueller soundtrack, Mo.
Well, yeah, I think it's the Paul McCartney of it all, isn't it? I think it's just I think I always assumed that was the real thing, right? It's the Beatles, Shake It Off,
Twist and Shout.
Is that not that, or is it that they're, or is it an interpolation of it? I can't remember, but there's definitely that.
They added some brass to it, and Paul was a bit offended. But I think, you know, you could just put out the soundtrack without that song and put something else in.
No, if that's all that was stopping them, I'm pretty sure that would be the case. But I learned at one point, and this is not about Ferris Bueller, but another film that we were excited about pursuing, but it's a film that had a notorious contentious production that like the studio are kind of like at this point, no one who worked at the studio back in the 80s is even, you know, involved in the studio now. So they're just sort of like, yeah, cool, let's figure it out. And then like all it takes is like a few weeks of looking into it and they go like, oh, this person who's still alive basically has a standing over my dead body stance on this. And so you just go ahead and hear, okay, well then maybe we wait until they are no longer with us. Yeah. And that changes things, you know? So yeah, it's tricky. Like I said, if it hasn't come out yet, there's a reason most times because there's, you know, like I said, there was a gold rush. And there's so many people who are pursuing these things and everyone has dollar signs around a very strangely small niche of things. But there's also the, if you don't do it, then it won't come out type of mentality, which as I'm looking at the Mission Impossible box set behind you that you have that I worked on, I also know that for a fact. And that is because the relationship with some people are also just terrified of certain filmmakers and their power and their things and blah, 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 and the complexities around it. And so working on the Mission Impossible things, it was really eye-opening to see that like once I had the ability to ask for approvals from Mr. Cruise, that everything became so much easier. And it was not a complicated process, but like some people are just don't cannot be bothered with it, you know, like it just is not part of their infrastructure to spend that much time on something that is only going to sell 1,000 or 2,000 copies, right?
Yeah.
So that's kind of what it is, you know, you need the small labels to take those risks and to just be like, I'm gonna make this because I want it to happen and I'm gonna spend 8 months working on it, you know, like, and just be like, this is gonna take me a year to make it, but I'm just gonna do it because it's important.
Going back to Over My Dead Body, I know you're a big big fan of Prince, and
yes,
that was Tarquin did help manage Prince at one point as well, so that's another link it all comes around. But I remember when I got into vinyl, Prince LPs were quite hard to find. They weren't out there as much as they are now, and as soon as he died a couple of years ago, I can't move for print reissues. It's crazy how that happens.
You can see in the lower right hand corner of my screen that I have a whole cube dedicated the box sets. To Prince.
Yeah.
The super deluxes, they're tough. I was also on a call the other day with an executive and she had the Diamonds and Pearls super deluxe, and I was like, oh fuck, I wasn't gonna buy that one, but now that you have it, I'm like, should I buy it? That's a tricky one, right? I mean, you don't realize it because we've lost him now 7 years, and it's like it's tragic, and you know his fans have never had more access to his stuff, and you know there's a philosophical debate as to whether or not that's what he would have ever wanted, in the same way that like any legacy artist, your Jim Morrison's, your Jerry Garcia's, your anyone who you've lost, you know, the amount of countless exploitation about their stuff that you eventually discover. And, you know, David Bowie, I'm sure, is going to have similar types of things expanded upon.
Sure.
You know, I also, while he was still alive, was actively pursuing doing the Batman soundtrack, an expanded version of that at one point. And it was interesting to see it happen, that like there was a time where it actually was like, yeah, we would talk about that, you know, and we actually have a relationship with the estate through a friend of a friend. And, you know, I was told what was in the vault for Batman and I was like, that's amazing. And this is what I would do with it. And I think that Warner Brothers is just going to do it themselves. But I really wanted to, and you know, at the same time, if it doesn't come out in 5 years, then I'm going to bother them again, because it does seem like there is the bandwidth concern. I think some people are like, we're going to do that ourselves. And then this doesn't happen because they don't have the time or they don't see the right amount of dollar signs. Josie and the Pussycats, to bring it around again. I remember when I asked about it once, I was like, can I do this? And they're like, yeah, sure. And then my boss at the time said, actually, that's not on brand. This is a little, you know, gossip for those who are nerdy about this. But like, you know, we had someone in charge who at one point told me very explicitly that things like That Thing You Do and Josie and the Pussycats were not on brand for Mondo. Yeah. And then when that person was no longer at the company, I was like, okay, I'm going to do this. And
let's go.
And when I asked about it again, they were like, actually, we're going to do it. And I was like, oh, okay, fine. And then a year went by and it didn't come out again. And so I was like, are you guys doing this or not? And they were like, actually, no, we've changed our minds. We're not going to do this. Yeah. So keep asking
is the name of the moral of the story.
Yeah, and always be nice. That's always the right thing to do. Very quick. Be understanding.
Sorry. Very quick question, because I know I need to let you go because we've gone way over time. Am I reading something into this? Mission Impossible 1, Tom Cruise, arms outsplayed. Mission Impossible 2, Tom Cruise, arms outsplayed. Mission Impossible 3, Tom Cruise, arms outsplayed. Mission Impossible 4, Tom Cruise, arms outsplayed, etc., etc. That's a decision, right? I'm the person that picked up on that.
The cover I picked, the only art rejection I got along any of those processes was I had a different cover for Ghost Protocol. And unfortunately, it was rejected. And it wasn't Tom Cruise arms outsplayed. It was Tom Cruise, also Burj Khalifa, being held by Simon Pegg, who's being held by Jeremy Renner. Yep. Like the ladder of them hanging out the window. It was a really great photo of that. And that's the only time we were ever told, like, that can't be the cover. And I think that isn't necessarily because they don't like that image, because that image is a key marketing image. It's out there. But I think that they have the brand has a very clear idea of danger, but not that much danger. Yeah. Peril, but like in control, like 30% more control than you think that he would be. And so, like, I don't know. It's just, I think that there's that where it's like him dangling is like, he's in control. It's a bad situation, but he's in control. The rock climbing, like, he can rock climb, but he's in a bad spot. You know, like, these are all images. That's me psychologically internalizing all these things, right? But no, I think it's just sometimes there's just the occasional gut check where someone involved in the process is like, I don't think that one's going to work.
Okay.
Can I see an alt? And then all of a sudden the alt comes and they're like, great, approved. And you're like, oh, okay. That was my second choice. But at the same time, I'm happy just to get this out there into the world. Because if I didn't have a second choice, then it just never would come out.
So is it a coincidence that he has his arms outsplayed on every cover? Or is that a conscious?
That's not a conscious thing. That's actually just, so when I created the first one, I didn't realize I was creating a template. And then, so when I had the template, I had to work within it. And it was the upper right-hand corner text. And once I started working within those boundaries, I had to find a way to make, because I went 1, 6, 2, 3, 4, 8 or 7. And so those are the order I worked on them. So by the time I got to, it was 1, then Fallout, and then I went to 2. And the assets that were available to me that were officially canonically approved by the studio, that was the key art. But both of those other ones are key art technically, and that's key art, but part 2 wasn't. And so they let me play around with what the assets they had, and that was the image that was the most stunty, because then I realized I was doing the stunts, right? Sure. And working on those backwards. Then I got to 3, and I remember putting that package together, and I was like, there's no great clean photo of a stunt from 3 that works. And I was like, this movie is about the relationship. And so, like, I kind of want to go with Michelle Moynihan on the cover too. And I was told by various people along the way, they were like, he will never approve a photo with him and anyone else.
Right.
And every single person who told me that was like, good luck. And then I sent it to him and he was like, approved.
So, again, the moral of the story, ask the question.
Ask the question.
Yeah.
Worst case scenario, they say no, but no, it was not that. So yeah, the arms outstretched thing, that image was just the best image that was out there for that worked within the template. And it fit to me the themes of that movie and what that movie was about. There are stunts in that movie, but like, I don't know what it is. Like, that movie has three has the most amazing run, and 3 has, you know, some really great jumping scenes, and the scene where he's falling, sliding down the tower. But like, there's just no really good, clean photography of that. Yeah, sorry, big tangent for those who don't know, for a very visual medium.
Tiny question before I ask you my big question that we'll hopefully end, because, yeah, we are running out of time. Bill Hicks. So you're in Austin. Yeah. Bill Hicks is a Houston like guy. He used to live in Houston. Do you think Mutant might ever do anything like Bill comedy? These original 4 LPs have never come out on vinyl. They're only on these are like outtake LPs.
Yeah.
But man, I love Bill.
That's a good question. You know, I this answers sort of the ethos of like what it is that we choose to do and what we don't. But really, it's about things that we feel sincere about doing because we believe in it, and not just going after things that we think are going to be good or that people want because we're just chasing a trend. If Spencer and I as curators don't really have a relationship to it, it's very likely we'll pursue it. Sometimes you get approached by people about things and we learn about them and they become interesting to us. That's how the singularity was. And we were friends with Bear and he reached out and was like, I have this album coming out next year. I would love for you guys to put the physical out on it. And I was like, well, I love your work, but I'd love to hear it first. And we heard it and I was like, this thing kind of rocks. Yeah. And so we decided to do that. And like, that's how it works, right? It's like, okay, let's consider it. But with comedy, I'm, you know, I don't have a very personal relationship. I mean, I love Bill Hicks. I've seen the doc, you know, I've heard a lot of his material. But I don't have a relationship to the stand-up comedy world, the outtakes, the things that have never been released. So it's very unlikely coming from Mutant, but never say never, because yeah, we do have, you know, some friends who work in those, because at Mondo, we were distributing a label that puts out the comedy records. We were working towards that. We worked together on a Richard Pryor record, some exclusives and stuff like that. So, you know, never say never, but at this point it's not on the short list. No.
Change your mind on that. Be fantastic to see, especially those first four Ryko Disc albums that he released in his lifetime. They're just perfect to me. Mo Shafiq, this has been an absolute pleasure to speak to you. I have one final question, and this is the big one. What film is absolutely perfect in your eyes?
I have two very boring answers. I'm going to flip a coin on which one to give you. But since I've already talked so much about the Wachowskis, I'll leave that off the table, but I'll say Back to the Future. I think Back to the Future. I have a tattoo on my chest of Back to the Future. It'd be weird. I feel kind of at a distance from it these days because I feel like everyone's gotten hip to Back to the Future being perfect. It's become the default answer. And it's weird now to feel like, oh, like I used to feel like I had a very intense private relationship with this film, and it's now just like everyone knows that it's perfect, so that doesn't necessarily make it less special, but it does remind me of when like my favorite bands broke out and all of a sudden we're playing bigger venues. I'm sort of like, that movie's always huge, but like I feel like leading up to the 30th anniversary, when it actually got to be 2015, that was the me seeing an organic ending to my Back to the Future fandom. I had a really good 30 years with it, and like I'm really proud of those 30 years of being obsessed with it. But now, even 7, 8, whatever, we're coming up on 10 years after that anniversary, that in my head I'm sort of like, well, who am I kidding? Like those movies are incredible, like masterpieces, endlessly quotable, tight as drums, screenplays, great performances, iconic, legendary, defined the rules of time travel for all media for the rest of time, like sci-fi tropes that are still being referenced to this day. This little weird comedy film starring a sitcom actor, directed by the guy who directed, you know,
two sitcom actors.
Romancing the Stone, you know, like, you know, like made this this little engine that could, that just absolutely continues to define sci-fi and comedy, you know, whether it's now its influence on things like Rick and Morty or just The Flash, which came out just last year, you know. It's pretty crazy.
Perfect answer. I'm going to let you go.
Sorry for recording the longest episode of all time with you.
it hasn't been the longest, but it's up there. But this has been an absolute honor to speak to you. Thank you so much for being so generous. And sorry.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We went over.
No, it's all right. I'm going to go and make some dinner and have a good weekend. I'm still a little jet lagged from my trip to Hawaii.
Of course.
So,
yeah.
It was a nice way to wind down the workday.
Nice. All the very best for Mutant. And I hope you, like I said before, I hope you go from strength to strength.
Thank you. And I really appreciate you reaching out and asking me to be on this show. It's been a joy to talk to you, and have me on again sometime.
I will. Please give Spencer a nudge. I've asked Spencer, but he didn't reply, but I don't know if he responds to private messages or not. So give him a little nudge next time you see him.
Like we were talking about social media, he's in the Facebook groups, but he's not maybe answering the DMs.
But
I think once the thing comes out, I'll definitely tell
Super.
Him. Yeah, of course.
Super. Great speaking to you, Mo. All the best, and have a great weekend.
Enjoy the rest of your Saturday.
That's it, man. Game over, man. It's game over.
A huge thank you to my guest, Mo Shafiq. If you're into movie soundtracks, check out my earlier conversations with John Hughes' music supervisors, Tarquin Gotch episode 22, and Ron Payne, episode 24. Thanks, as always, to James Van Ness, who wrote and performed the brilliant podcast music, and to Willow Van Ness, who designed the amazing artwork and provided general podcast support. If you're enjoying this podcast, please leave a rating and a review on your favourite podcast platform. You can follow the show on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter at MyMovieDNA, or email mymoviedna@gmail.com.